Please come back with me to James chapter 1. And this evening we'll be looking at verses 5 through to verse 8 in James chapter 1. And we'll have 3 points through those verses, and then we'll have 2 applications at the end. So that's James 1 and verses 5 through to verse 8. But very quickly, and hopefully it'll be quite quick, it's just a recap of where we are as we're jumping sort of into James's letter. We've looked at it a couple of Sundays before last week. So just to catch up with where we are and set out some thoughts. And first of all, very briefly when we started, we thought about what faith is according to God, that it's a replacement eye, a sense that overrules all other senses. And more than that, it defines who I am. It defines everything about me. And it's so interwoven and part of me that to throw my faith away, it's not the case of faith is the spiritual part of me, sort of throw that away and I have something left, or it's the Sunday part of me. No, it's interwoven so much into me that to throw my faith away is to throw me away. So when the Bible says, put your faith in Christ, it's not saying, put your hopes in, if you like, in eternity in Christ, and it doesn't mean anything now, just sort of have a pinned hope over there. It doesn't mean sort of what you do in parts of the week, or it's the religious part of you saying, put your everything into him. And we also considered an attribute of faith. The faith increases and grows if we're converted, if we know and love the Lord. Faith doesn't come all at once. It's not like a light switch that suddenly switches on and I once was one thing and now I am fully what I am to be overnight. Faith comes gradually, it increases and grows. It's never more real or alive. It's always as real and alive on day one, but it does become more capable and more than what it was. And then we got into verses 2 and 3, setting those things in order. And James begins verse 2, he says, count, intentionally declare is what he means. Make the conscious choice to declare trials. Trials being situations you encounter in life. Various things, difficult times, more easy times, work, career, all those sorts of things, trials that you encounter that demand you to choose faith, choose Christ and how you see eternity and act in that way differently to other things. Choose those things, consciously make those things reasons to celebrate, even though they might be hard. Fiery trials, Peter talks about, painful times, deep, emotionally hard things to suffer. Still count those things as reasons to rejoice. Why, says James? Because that's being part of God's academy. It's how Christians are grown, shaped, matured. God is looking to approve your faith, and whilst he's doing it, he's improving it. To show it to be genuine, he also makes it genuine and makes it bigger, greater in size, and makes it more what it should be. And trials are where the rubber hits the road. It's the real experience. The theory of testing is a reality when we go through trials. Hence, we can declare them as reasons to rejoice, despite everything else we may find about them that are not worthy of rejoicing in. And then we came to verses 4 and 5. And we saw that trials are not just experiences we simply last through. It's not the case that a trial is a bomb, we get into the bunker, we seal the doors, and we last through the 3 to 6 hours, the 6 to 9 months of difficulty, and then we emerge at the end and the weather is great again. They achieve far more than that, says James in verses 4 and as we stepped into verse 5. Trials themselves do something to you, and they do it through you going through them. That's why endurance has a work. It does more than simply get you to the other side. It makes more of you. It's an opportunity to be fully exploited, which is to be fashioned and shaped by the things you're going through to make you more godly. To have all those dynamics of faith, how you see the world, how you understand everything, how you live, act, operate, how you love others, forgive others, deal with others, your routines, everything that defines you, that faith governs, trials make bigger. Make better, make you more Christ-like. And therefore, those opportunities should be exploited. The last thing we would want, if I was to flip it the other way round, is we wouldn't want to go through many things in trials and gain little out of them. If we go through much in trials, we want to gain in much godliness in them, is James's point. And of course, as we enter verse 5 a couple of weeks ago, when we face trials and we're directed by faith through them, what do we need? What's the overriding quality that we need? We need wisdom. Wisdom, Proverbs tells us, is the quality that keeps us from stumbling. If trials are about making decisions and choices and following faith, wisdom allows us to make the right ones. And wisdom in the Bible is a little bit different to how we often think of wisdom. The world thinks of a wise man, I suppose a bit like I'm standing here, someone who apparently has a lot to say and declares it and everyone is to listen. The Bible's view of a wise man is different. The Bible's view of a wise man is a person always in pursuit of something. He's always under instruction. He's always under counsel, something you'll notice in Proverbs. He's never the one talking, he's always the one listening. Wisdom is something that is always pursued, and the wise man is always in pursuit of it. And that's all by way of reminder. That's where we got to. Faith, trials, God's academy, enduring through, exploiting them, need of wisdom. So let's carry on, verses 5-8. I'm going to read this in the ESV. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives generously to all without reproach, and it will be given him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting. For the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. For he is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. Verse 5 then, and point number 1 is this. Wisdom must be sought. Wisdom must be sought. Where do you go to when you need wisdom? Particularly when you're hitting difficult life situations and you're feeling under pressure. Where do you turn to? Where do you seek counsel and advice? Well, James says the first person you should go to, you probably argue the exclusive person he says to go to, is God. He is the giver of wisdom, and he's rightly the giver of wisdom, because he is the source of wisdom. Proverbs 2 verse 6 tells us that God is the source of all wisdom. And if we're in God's academy, if he is training us, shaping us, and fitting us, and he's looking to make us the first fruits of his creatures, verse 18 in chapter 1, if God is seeking our good and bringing our faith to completion and perfection, verse 4 of chapter 1, it makes perfect sense that God is the one we go to if we wish to have greater understanding. When we are in trials and we feel flummoxed, if we are going through life and we feel flummoxed, that we go to God as the source of wisdom. And James says God is generous. In fact, God is overflowing in wisdom to give. In so much as God offers grace and mercy, and we often think of those things, and the many other good things God gives, he also gives generously in wisdom. And God's hand is free and open in wisdom, because generosity and being generous is about being ready to give more than is needed. Sometimes when we think of trials, and I sometimes think of this, we can sort of picture life or trials as a barren wilderness. It's a hot sun, there are palm branches everywhere, but very few and far between, and the palm trees, and it's hot, and you're hungry and thirsty, and that's sort of the picture of life, and I'm treading through it. And then you can sometimes sort of think, because I often do this, that God is a bit like the Red Cross at various stops, and he's got the essential wisdom supplies, and they're tightly bound rations, and they're sort of the things that we need, the essentials to carry us home, to see us through. And that is how God gives. That is how he gives wisdom. He sort of supplies only our needs, if I can put it like that. But James says he's generous. Generosity means he has far more than is needed at his disposal. And that is how he gives. So in fact, it's quite wrong to sort of think of God being sort of the first aider, the Red Cross on the road to heaven. He's actually far more set a great wisdom feast. He has a king's banquet of wisdom at his disposal. It's an all-you-can-eat buffet of wisdom delicacies, generosity at his hand. And it's given without discrimination. It's not given on how worthy you are. It's given without reproach, James says. And reproach is to, if you reproach someone, you're making a judgment about them because they've done something negative. You say, well, I'm going to discriminate them and I'm going to upbraid them because they've done something bad. It actually says, God doesn't look at you and say, I will only give you wisdom because you've done good things, because you've earned the right to have it. God sets no threshold, a barrier to entry, such that you can gain the wisdom that you need. He doesn't exclude based on past failings, and he doesn't exclude based on future faults. It's an open and overflowing hand of all wisdom. But there is one barrier. But it's not necessarily a barrier that God puts in the way. It's a barrier that perhaps we sort of set ourselves. Because the only thing that is demanded is that we ask, which isn't really a barrier, is it? But it is something we have to do. We must ask. We must actually come to the banquet, if you like, the wisdom feast, God at God's hand, his overflowing generosity and wisdom. We actually have to come and collect it. The key quality to gaining wisdom is to ask. It's not given without asking. Wisdom isn't encountered by chance. I don't stumble across it ignorantly. It's not channeled to the unexpected individual sort of one night. Whoa, I have gained wisdom. I must ask God for it. And again, thinking of a banquet and a buffet, this is a slightly bizarre illustration. But you don't go to a banquet and buffet, do you? And whilst you're talking to your friends, people throw food into your mouths at distance. Go on, get some of this in. Also, you don't arrive and the stewards don't pin you down and force feed and say, come on, have the wisdom. No. You must ask. You must come and collect. In fact, you could almost go and say that a starving man can die at the table if he refuses to put his hand to his mouth. That's the picture that James is presenting to us. We must ask. James doesn't say that wisdom is given to those who need it. He doesn't say that those who enter trials will just be given the wisdom that they need. God gives wisdom because I have asked, because I have sought it. I am made wise because I am asked. I have asked. I am not made wise because I was stupid. But I can ask with great comfort. I can ask with a guarantee that I will receive. Because God gives without reproach. But wisdom must be sought. Verse 6 says, but let him ask in faith, with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. Wisdom must be sought, yes, but wisdom must be sought in faith. It's the caveat that James throws in. It's an interesting caveat. I've heard, not necessarily Amy and Park, but people enthusiastically quote James 1 verse 5 and then ignore verse 6. The asking must be in faith. The provision of wisdom from God is only to someone who is asking by the sense that supersedes all others, their faith. They are asking God, saying, Lord, you are the one who has faith. You are the one who is generous and freely willing to give it. That's why I've come to ask. And importantly, which is why James goes on into the wave being tossed by the sea. I ask in faith, meaning that I ask, putting my faith in the wisdom that is given. Because then I exercise and use it. That's the crucial point. It's not just that I ask believing God has wisdom and that he will give it. But it's saying that if it is the wisdom that God gives, I therefore place my trust in it to use it. I have to ask in faith. God gives wisdom to those who ask and to those who ask rightly. That is what it is to ask in faith. Wisdom is not something that I know. It is something that I live. And wisdom must be sought in faith. And James continues, point number three, that it must be sought with a single mind of faith. It must be sought single-mindedly with faith. 6, 7 and 8 again. But let him ask in faith with no doubting, for the one who doubts is like a wave of the sea that is driven and tossed by the wind. For that person must not suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. If I'm facing trials and lacking in wisdom, and I come to God and ask for wisdom, and I doubt, and maybe my doubting takes the form of this, I decide that God has nothing to contribute. My asking is only to ask, if you like, for what I already know to be confirmed, because I already know what the answer is, I already know what's best. I'm either asking God to simply ratify it, or I'm asking for others to come into line with my opinion because I already know what the right answer is. Doubt, God has nothing to contribute. Or maybe I'm asking God, doubting in the sense that I decide that God won't give anything. I need wisdom, and maybe I've counseled Gerard or others about this difficult situation. He's asked me to pray, but I've only gone to pray because I was asked to. So I've gone through my routine. I'm supposed to ask, so I will go through the process of asking. Or maybe I doubt slightly differently, and that is I doubt in the sense that God's wisdom is just simply one of the options. In the counsel of my faith, I invite God in amongst a lot of other people. They all have an equal say, and I just want to hear if God has something interesting, a spin on something that I hadn't considered that might be helpful. What happens if I ask on those terms? What happens if that is my attitude to God and his wisdom? What happens if I encounter trials, life experiences, painful ones, hard ones, real struggles, and that is my attitude to what God has to say on the matters? I will be a chaos, won't I? I will be a wave driven by the sea. I'll be all over the place. I'm asking for wisdom. I'm asking God for things. On the one hand, yes. But on the other hand, I'm faithless. So I decide what I'm going to do in my situations anyway. It's like I've got two people warring inside of me. Double-minded, James says. The word literally means a person with two spirits. On the one hand, I'm being pulled one direction. I'll ask God, yes. And on the other hand, I'm being pulled another direction. But ignore what he has to say. You already know best. Being pulled in different directions. I ask, but what God gives, I ignore. And trials that are supposed to increase and drive me single-mindedly to God on an ever-increasing curve to perfection are instead revealing that I do this. I go all over the place. I ask but don't want, I receive but don't use, because I'm doubting. I'm all over the place, I'm a chaos. And the thing is, when we talk of wisdom, when we talk of faith, it's very easy to think of this as a sort of a relationship to God matter, a heart matter, something internal on the inside that no one can see. It's sort of a matter between me and God. When I'm in my quiet moments, in my quiet times, it's there where this is happening. It's there where the battle is happening. It's where it can be seen. But outside of those things, it's a mystery. People can't see. I'd have to have a deep conversation with someone where I would reveal that this is my experience. There's a danger that we think that, because actually, James says the total opposite. Actually, this battle will be evident and seen to everybody. because you're unstable in all your ways. Every aspect of your life will be a testament to your instability. It's not an indiscernible heart matter. It's something people can see. The battle is something that you'll be wearing. It won't be difficult for people to put their finger on it. Your life will be a flip-flop between things. One minute all is well. One minute there seems passion and faithfulness and real heartfelt consideration for things. There's a real desire for God to seek his face. And then all of a sudden the next minute is like catastrophe. What's happened? Trial has come and things seem to be this way, and suddenly it's the total opposite direction. There's a passion for one thing, passion over here, maybe it's evangelism, I need to evangelize, why isn't the church doing evangelizing? And then suddenly it's like, actually, I think Bible studies need to be very important, scrap evangelism, need to do this. And then suddenly it's like, actually, I don't know what's important anymore. There's suddenly everything's important. Why aren't we focusing on everything? Things are all over the place. Something driven by the wind. I flip-flop. Every direction. In front of all decisions, trials and situations, confusion and error reigns. Whether the person sees it or not, it is something that will be evident because they're unstable in everything that they're doing. The only thing that's certain with them is their wobbliness. How do you respond to an unstable person? If you saw that sort of a person in front of you, how would you respond and interact with them? You'd probably be a bit edgy. Maybe have some proverbial tongs that you handle them with. You're not quite sure how you can trust them, what you can entrust to them, what they will do with it, what they will do in situations. I sort of know what they might do here. But if these things were to happen, I don't know. They might go completely opposite. They might fly off the handle. And you'll be a bit confused by them. Why? Because they are unstable. One sense, it's obvious, isn't it, when you think about what an unstable person is, what someone with two spirits warring inside them looks like. You suddenly go, actually, this is something that can be very evident. This person will grope and stumble, won't they, around. They'll bumble and trip through trials, through life. Always all over the place. And sadly, James says, and this is the tragedy of it, isn't it? In amongst everything he has said up until verse 7, he says that the person who is like this will receive nothing and should expect to receive nothing from God. That's the challenge, isn't it? In wisdom, in trial, there's a stark warning from James that we must be single-minded. And those who are not single-minded will bear it out. And if we're all being honest with ourselves, we've probably encountered people that aren't single-minded, and we know how they're treated, or how we might treat them. And it might beg the question as to how others might be treating us because of what we display. So verses 5 to 8. Wisdom must be sought. Wisdom must be asked for. It must be sought and asked with faith, but single-mindedly with faith. So briefly, two applications. The first one is this. Very simply, do not be unstable. In the way you approach everything, be single-minded in faith. Are you unstable in faith? I wonder. You may have noticed, or you may have felt it, or maybe as we went through the little narrative of what an unstable person looks like, do you feel that you have two people warring within you? You may be going through trials and all those sorts of difficulties, and you plead for wisdom, and you go, why am I not receiving it? Why am I seeming to be left out? But I ask of God. And now suddenly it becomes clear. It's not that you don't ask. It's that you don't ask rightly. You do not ask with a single-mindedness on faith. Think of this. What are these things? Let's practically draw it out. Imagine maybe you're someone like this. You're at work. And you are, I'll use my glasses as an illustration as I switch bits. Imagine you're a person at work and you put on faith and you share the gospel. You see opportunities and you're wholehearted in them. You're passionate for them. You're sharing it with your colleagues. You're inviting them to services. You're trying to do studies. You may be attending a Christian union at work. Faith is being worn. You're seeing the opportunities. But then when it actually comes to working, faith comes off. And working is just like everybody else. Work is arrived at a little bit late. You leave a little bit early. Delivery is always, getting things done is always a little bit slack. Quality is a little bit low. There's all the backbiting and various work politics you're playing. Faith in one sense is being worn. In another sense, it's not. You're sitting down around your kitchen table and you're checking your finances and faith is worn. And as you're looking over your finances, you see there's money, obviously, and you tithe. And you say, tithe, well, things are very tight, maybe not quite 10%. Well, actually, I'm going to do a little bit more. And you say it's very passionate, very good to give to the Lord's work and want to give to the Lord's work. How much can I afford? And then once that's done, you take faith off. Because the rest of the money is yours, isn't it? And it's spent on all that you desire. It's Sunday morning and faith is again put on. As you read and you pray, you attend Sunday services, you love the Lord's Day, you love gathering with His people, studying His Word, seeing what He has to say. You love meeting with Him and with His people. And then Monday morning comes and faith is removed. Because God only asks for one day in seven, doesn't He? That's the Lord's Day. Of course, actually, He demands all 7 days. He just has one day. Do it. You do something a little bit different to the other six, but they're all seven His. Maybe it's a church meeting and faith is worn and you pray over church matters. You're very keen that God is glorified in them. But then when the matters are discussed, faith is removed. And now it's all about what you would like the church to do, what you think is best and where everything should be invested and what should be happening. Maybe it's a situation for service, and again, faith is worn. You identify the needs of the church. You are passionate for the Lord in the church. You identify many different ways where God may be glorified. Maybe, oh, I think this fellowship groups could be done like this, and this could happen, and maybe we could evangelize in this way, and we need to get this going and that going. And people are like, wow, this is really good, really zealous and enthusiastic. And then suddenly faith is removed. Because it's always a lot easier to talk about the Lord's work than participate in it. Is that us? Double-minded and unstable. We encounter situations and wisdom of how faith should really be governed and directing how we live and operate is only on maybe some of the time. There are many other ways we could illustrate. There are other ways of double-mindedness. We'll stick with this one. Is that what we're like? And therefore people can't place us. They feel it difficult to trust things with us, because how can you trust someone to serve if they only really ever talk about it? How can you trust someone to take ownership of something in church life if, though they seem to pray so spiritually over it, the way they dispense with it seems to be their own personal interests? How can you promote people as examples in church life, if the only time Christianity seems to mean much to them is between 12 a.m. and 12 a.m. on Sunday. Unstable. On the one hand, there seems to be such faith, and on the other hand, such a conspicuous absence of it. A pendulum. Think of it slightly differently. A pendulum between anger and gentleness. Fruits of the Spirit seems to just turn on and off at will. Patience on the one hand, there's sudden frustration. Sympathy, then intolerance. Submission, but then rebellion. Flip-flopping. Faith always on, then suddenly off, then on, then off, then on, then off. The danger signs are there, aren't they? Alarm bells should be ringing, two spirits warring. One that wants to wear the faith and the other one that wants to take them off. Alarm bells should be ringing. And why should they ring? Because God says something really profound, doesn't he? Double-minded people won't receive and shouldn't expect to receive anything from me. If I really want to gain out of trials, if I go through much gain much in godliness, double-mindedness ensures we go nowhere. It's something we need to be really vigilant on, isn't it? James, if you read the rest of James chapter 1, you see how James is so direct, and you can understand why he is, because he sees the importance and the urgency of it. We need to be testing ourselves on this, don't we? Am I single-mindedly governed by faith? Do I ask God for wisdom in all my situations in faith? Not that he has wisdom to give, not that he will give it, but that upon the receipt of it, I trust it as the wisdom of God, always. And it is never in competition with something else. Because if it's in competition, you need to root it out, don't we? Which begs the question. Do we ask the pastor? Gerard probably has a better view than most of us of our double-mindedness. Do we ask our good Christian friends? Because they probably see us in all sorts of situations that we don't. And do we ask them for honesty in their opinion and view? Because our double-mindedness will not be this internalized conflict that they cannot see. It will be an express one that they will easily see. And we should want to put it right, shouldn't we? Because the competition is robbing us of God's blessing. And finally, application number 2 is simply this. Ask God for wisdom. Ask God for wisdom. God stands with open hands, with wisdom delicacies, more than we need. And he has all that we need and more to succeed in trials. So when we're hit with trials and when tragedies come, I know from personal experience there are many things that in trials I have wanted. But what I really needed was to be diligently seeking the wisdom of God. In fact, long before those situations arose, there was something I needed to have been doing. And something I should have already been done, being doing, and done continuously. Which was diligently seeking the wisdom of God. And though it's obvious, where do we find God's wisdom first and foremost? We find in his word, don't we, a wisdom that he freely gives and has given us. Therefore, are we seeking wisdom in God's wisdom? And when we seek it, do we apply it? Does it become our wisdom? And God's wisdom is something strange. It's something that is very painful. I certainly find that God's wisdom is very painful. And God's wisdom always jars and irks me. Because it often tells me that someone else is right. And that I got it wrong. In fact, quite a lot of the time, it tells me that someone else has the right to decide and I don't. It often takes decisions out of my hands. And where I would like some grey answer to give me a bit of liberty, God provides a black and white moral answer. And it often exposes my wrong thinking. and where my wrong thinking has become my wrong teaching. And an understanding that I've then applied to my life, and I may have done it all my Christian life up until now, and his wisdom undoes it. He says, I was wrong. That's the painful part of God's wisdom. It's one of its key facets, 2 Timothy 3:16. Paul actually, when he lists four facets, two of them are reproof and correction, two things that aren't particularly enjoyable to experience. That's what God's word does, what his wisdom does. I like having my understanding added to. I don't like having my understanding changed. Particularly when I've invested so much of myself down a particular path already. That's what it is to ask for God's wisdom, isn't it? To ask for it, I must submit to it. To ask it means I have to apply it. And it may make some very painful decisions necessary. I remember a number of years ago, maybe 15, 20 years ago, the pastor at my previous church, he had an impromptu church meeting. He just turned up with a paper. He liked writing papers. He was originally a scientist. And he said, there's going to be no debate. The church rules are just being changed because I do not believe the Bible supports this particular church rule. And it was just accepted and changed. He said, there can be no discussion on it. Discussion would be wrong. So the Bible does not teach this. Ironically, in 1992, he had written a paper defending the church rules on the same matter. And for 50 years as a pastor, he had held to it staunchly. And I thought it was an amazing example where someone probably went to write a paper thinking that it's the most awkward and embarrassing thing ever to say that you, for 50 years of being a pastor, you've been wrong. Well, actually, I came away thinking, who more would you want to trust than someone, even after 50 years of getting it wrong, is willing to still submit to God's word to get it right? Proverbs 12, verse 1 says this, and a lot of other places, says that fools, or perhaps more offensively, stupid people, hate correction. Wise people stand firm on what is right. Proud people stand on anything that they hold to. We need wisdom, don't we? And we need to seek it. Always be seeking it. Always asking in faith for it. Being fashioned by it. And the wisdom from God will often jar and irk us. This is why prayer is so important. Because we need God's help and direction, don't we? To become wise, I need to be broken and humbled. I need God's eye-opening Holy Spirit to give me discernment on his word. We need, don't we, to be a prayerful church for our collective wisdom and our individual wisdom. We need to pray for God's hand to be providing a torrential wisdom upon us. Because if we're to face trials, if we're to really grow through them, if we are to go through much and gain much godliness out of them, obey James's commands, we need wisdom, don't we? We really do. I'd like to close just with an example of someone who faced a trial and how they faced it. And it's the example of Jesus himself. He was confronted with the greatest trial. It lay ahead of him. It was the cross. And we thought of it this morning. Where was this trial for Jesus conquered? Where was this trial dealt with? Where was what this trial was in all its pain, suffering, anguish, and gravity of being faced? Where did he triumph over it? It was in Gethsemane. Jesus had lived a life soaked in the scriptures. He lived a life soaked in prayer. We can read it in the Gospels. And before the trial came, where is he found? He is found in prayer in Gethsemane. His prayer is all about his coming trial. It's all about preparing himself for it. And in it, he asks for wisdom. He asks for wisdom because he asks God, he says, is there another way, Lord? If there is another way, let that be the way you will lead me down. But if there isn't another way, I will go your way. He asks of God, and he submits to the wisdom of God in the cross. Preparation is complete. Because what do we read in Matthew 26? And it's a bizarre statement, because Jesus just matter-of-factly says to his disciples, "Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." Because the trial had been dealt with in Gethsemane. There's no wavering, no emergency prayer sessions. Quickly, we must go somewhere else. I have no idea what's happening. He has dealt with his trial in Gethsemane. Wouldn't it be a real tragedy if we do the thing that James warns us to do, not to do? And that is to let us rob ourselves of our own growth. To know that double-mindedness, lack of wisdom, lack of preparedness gains us nothing. And then to go forward robbing ourselves of everything God could give and make us through what we are to face. James tells us how we should approach trials. Jesus lives out the perfect example of how to face trials. Let us face them like he did. Let us face them with a single-minded faith.